What I'm interested in is, what are we trying to hold on to?
From atop the Lowell State Theater building,
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 from WNYC and Public Radio International. Today we hear about the unearthly allure of a particularly American style of old music.
I wouldn't walk across the street to hear it, but would walk 200 miles to sing it.
And we find out about the challenges of preserving contemporary art made of some unusual materials.
Chocolate, lard, hair dye, CoverGirl Thick Lash Mascara.
My special guest today is radio producer and MacArthur genius David Isay, and we'll talk about the art of preservation. All that and more ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. Last December, the jazz legend Milt Hinton died at the age of 90. Milt Hinton led a fabulous life. He was a superb, pioneering jazz bassist who played on more records than anyone else ever did or probably ever will. At least 600, maybe 1,000 different recordings, maybe more.
I jammed with Benny Goodman, with Basie, Duke, and Earl. Played England with Bing Crosby and the Middle East with Pearl.
But that wasn't all, and that's my point. For a half a century, Milt Hinton was also, on the side, a serious photographer. His hundreds of images of the people he knew and played with make up a beautiful, intimate documentary chronicle of the jazz pantheon of the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, pictures that only Milt Hinton could make. I find that I have a special affection and admiration for successful artists with the daredevil energy to leap into new realms that they have no business leaping into. Artists with the combination of ambition and talent and heart to try a second or third career instead of just coasting along in one. I'm not talking here about the new celebrity cottage industry in children's books, where people famous from television and film get to call themselves authors by putting their names on very thin books with lots of pictures. For a movie star to publish a children's book involves no danger of overreaching, no risk of major failure. And risk of major failure is what anything important, any project that aspires even to the vicinity of art, requires. Julian Schnabel became rich and famous as a painter in the 1980s, repeatedly taking big artistic risks. He glued broken crockery to giant canvases. His arrogance was often insufferable. And he failed regularly, but failed a lot of the time in interesting, ambitious ways. Schnabel is now a movie director as well as a painter, and bully for his I-can-do-anything hubris, because his first film, based on the life and death of the painter Jean-Michel Basquiat, was charming, and his second film, Before Night Falls, based on the life of the Cuban poet Reynaldo Arenas, opened earlier this year, and it's a luscious, stunning piece of work.
Water rushed down gutters, reverberating over the zinc roof like gunfire. A massive army marching across the trees.
Or take Steve Martin.
Excuse me!
Like a lot of comedians, he turned himself into a movie actor. And like a lot of actors, he then became a movie director. But like no other actor-director I know about, Steve Martin is also an accomplished playwright. And now, with Shop Girl, a best-selling novelist.
The glove department is adjacent to the couture department and is really there for show. So a lot of Mirabelle's day is spent leaning against the glass case with one leg cocked behind her.
Okay, novellaist, but whatever. It's still a hugely impressive show of discipline and ambition and breadth. When people like Steve Martin or Milt Hinton move from one realm to another, each craft can enrich and color the next, and then the next. What do we call this MO that I'm celebrating? Multitasking? Dabbling? Dilettantism? The amateur spirit on steroids? Renaissance man? Renaissance man seems like a quaint, corny phrase, but maybe that's because in this age of credentials and specialization, our language has become biased against the remarkable people with the audacity to do more than one thing well. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Each week in Studio 360, we explore design for the real world, finding out why everyday things look the way they do, from typefaces to Swiss Army knives. One of the most effective designs around is the stop sign. We see it, we obey. In this week's Design for the Real World, graphic designer Stephen Heller explains why this symbol is so powerful.
Everybody knows what a stop sign is. That's what's great about a stop sign. You know what it means without having to be literate in the language that may be impressed upon it. All you have to do is see it. It's easy to overlook blue because the sky is blue. It's easy to overlook green because the grass is green. But red, you stop for red. You stop for red lipstick. It's the symbolic force of that color that makes it viable. The eight-sidedness, I think, has to do with how it sits in the landscape. It breaks up the visual space. It isn't as common on the street as a circle or a triangle or a square or a rectangle. The stop sign is used in other contexts. It's not simply a traffic sign. You can put as much eye-catching imagery as you want on a billboard or a website or in a magazine. But once that stop sign is placed on a page, you stop. You instinctively stop. There's no choice in the matter. Stop doesn't give you choice.
Stephen Heller is the author of more than 70 books on design, including most recently The Swastika, Symbol Beyond Redemption. Do you have a question about design for the real world? If you do, let us know about it. You can reach us through our website at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, where every few weeks we investigate another aspect of how art works. Today we take a look at the giant portraits of painter Chuck Close. When you're right up in front of a Chuck Close painting, you see the amazing, obsessive, gridded field of abstract flecks of tint and hue. But looked at as a whole from a little farther away, the painting's grids disappear, and each portrait is seen as an impeccable, monumental likeness of its human subject. These paintings were a revelation for Dennis Pelley, who's a professor of psychology and neural science at New York University. He spoke with Studio 360's Jocelyn Gonzalez about how Chuck Close unwittingly collaborated with him on a significant neurological discovery.
So this is a painting of Chuck Close's of William Wegman, the guy who does books about dogs. And as you see, it's made up of squares, and it's a little over a centimeter per square. At this distance, you can, I'm sure, tell that it's a face, and you can make out that there are eyes here and there's some lips here. But in the region where there should be a nose, I think you might find that it looks really like a flat part of skin, as though someone had surgically excised the nose and just left a flat patch of skin, slightly discolored as though he had some sort of suntan lotion on or something. But as we back away, I think you see that when we get far enough away.
Maybe you have
suddenly,
to go like across the street.
Well, no, I think by now, so you can still
see. Oh, wait, I see it.
But you can still see all the blocks, right?
Yeah.
And yet, even though the face is made up of blocks, suddenly it's a three-dimensional face, so you see the nose emerging. And not only that, but the skin looks healthy. You can see that it's all uniform skin, but non-uniformly illuminated. So that part that was light, which before we thought was suntan lotion, from here, you can see it's just a highlight where it's catching the light. And so this is this phenomenon. And then if we walk back and forth, you can find a certain point where the nose just emerges for you. And that would be your critical distance. We had been studying how we see letters. And we'd done a lot of work on how we identified the letter ABC, that sort of thing. And one of the things we discovered, which was quite unexpected to us, was that we see letters differently at different sizes. With very large letters, we identify the letter by means of details like the serifs and so on, are important in that, the edges. And as the letters get smaller and smaller, we tend to use more and more the centers of the strokes, the gross form. And we had imagined that the problem of how you recognize a form in general and a letter in particular is such a difficult problem that once the visual system figured out how to do it, it would just do it in the same way at all sizes. The idea of shape in the dictionary is defined as a property that's independent of size. And here we were showing that our method for perceiving shape is actually dependent on size. And so we thought we had this great discovery, and we were in the process of sending a paper off to a vision research journal. And then I happened to go to this Chuck Close retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art. And like everyone else at the gallery, I was walking back and forth in front of the paintings and noticing how dramatically the paintings changed as you walk back and forth. And I suddenly realized that this was demonstrating that shape depended on size. And not only was this in a parallel to the thing that we thought we had discovered, but Chuck Close had been exhibiting these paintings in public for more than 10 years, and so he'd scooped us.
Dennis Pelley is a professor of psychology at New York University. If you'd like to see some of the images he talked about, visit our website at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it is time now for our cover story. Today we're looking at preservation, exploring what we choose to preserve and how music and art and literature are changed by the efforts to conserve and preserve them. This is a question that deeply concerns my special guest today, radio producer David Isay, who has spent much of his time in radio producing stories about preserving memory, preserving physical space, and artistic endeavors. David is the founder of Sound Portraits Productions, and you may have heard some of his amazing documentaries on public radio, including Ghetto Life 101 and the absolutely mind-blowing Sunshine Hotel. David is currently producing the Yiddish Radio Project, unearthing and retelling the story of the golden age of Yiddish radio. David, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, Kirk. Good to be here.
Well, let's start with an excerpt from one of your most recent pieces, the documentary Witness to an Execution. We'll hear from the Reverend Carol Pickett, who has witnessed the execution of almost 100 inmates at Huntsville in Texas, here describing what it's like to spend the last few seconds with a condemned prisoner.
After they're strapped down and the needles are flowing, and you've got probably 45 seconds where you and he are together for the last time, and nobody can hear what goes on there. And the conversation that took place in there were, well, basically indescribable. It was always something different. The guy would say, "I want you to pray this prayer." One of them would say, "You know, I just want to tell you thank you." One of them would say, "Don't forget to mail my letters." Another one would say, "Just tell me again, is it going to hurt?" One of them would say, "What do I say when I see God?" You know, you've got 45 seconds, and you're trying to tell a guy what to say to God.
That was an excerpt from Witness to an Execution by David Isay and his collaborator on this project, Stacey Abramson. Why did you decide to do this particular project, David?
Well, I mean, I think that the way I go about most projects is this window opened and we leapt through it. I mean, we had this opportunity to get into the Walls Unit at Texas where these executions happen, and the staff was willing to open up to us and talk to us. They'd never really talked before about this stuff. So we went down and did it. It was sort of one of those kismet things.
Why were they so open?
All we did was ask. I mean, these guys, as far as they were concerned, everything in this story is absolutely true. I mean, the warden is thrilled with it. Everybody down in Huntsville is thrilled with it. This is what happens. They do these executions. It's hard for them. Nobody likes to do these things. And you know, I think they felt like they'd have an opportunity to tell their story the way that they, you know, felt was true, and tell it with some kind of semblance of dignity, and that their words weren't going to get mangled. And that's what happened.
And it captures beautifully, I think, the ambiguity of their role. And it is not a screed against the death penalty by any means, but one can't listen to it without thinking of the price that performing the death penalty exacts from these individuals and, by extension, I guess, all of us.
Absolutely. And another thing that we were hoping to accomplish with this piece is to kind of lay out what exactly happens in the Texas death chamber between 6 o'clock and 6:20 p.m. almost once a week now. You know, no execution has ever been filmed. No execution has ever been taped. The only physical documentary we have of an execution is the famous Daily News photograph from 1928 from Sing Sing Penitentiary, when a reporter lifted up his pant leg and snapped that picture of Ruth Snyder, a woman who was being executed. So part of what we did with these folks who do this week after week after week is just lay out, you know, detail by detail, exactly what happens in the death chamber and kind of shine a light on this hidden part of America, which is kind of our mission.
Well, you do shine lights on shadowy parts of America, whether it's flop houses or snake handlers or the execution halls of Texas. How did you enter this world of radio?
I was 22 years old, and I was headed actually to medical school. I was at NYU and had graduated and was in medical school, but postponed for a year because I knew that's not what I wanted to do. And I was kind of teaching, tutoring college kids on psychology, what I majored in, and psych statistics and all this sort of mathematical stuff that I was pretty good at. And one day I was walking through the East Village, and which was the neighborhood that I've lived in for a long time now here in Manhattan. And I passed a storefront that caught my eye. There was something just really folk arty about it. It was like this 12-step recovery kind of store where they have, different stuff about addiction recovery and alcoholism. But it wasn't like corny at all. There was something really kind of magical about it. And I went in the store, and it was run by this Puerto Rican couple. And the two of them were recovering heroin addicts, and they both had AIDS. And this was 88, so they weren't going to live for too long. And they took me to the back of the store, and they showed me this plan for a museum that they wanted to build to addiction. And they had kind of meticulously built it out of tongue depressors and toothpicks. And it was this amazing, like, 8-story model. And then they pulled out these blueprints of every floor of the museum and every exhibit of the museum. And it was just spectacular. And they were planning, they believed they could raise the $10 million they needed to build this museum. And it was just extraordinary. It was really magical what they were trying to do. And they had all these letters from Donald Trump and all these folks who they'd written to, writing them back saying, this is a wonderful project. I'm sure you'll get the money. I'm not going to give you the money, which they took not as a form letter, but as a letter of encouragement. And they thought they'd eventually get the money. Anyway, they totally blew me away. And I went home that night, and I'd never listened to public radio or heard of public radio or community radio. I just started going through the yellow pages of television stations and calling all the local television stations and pitching the story to them, saying you should do a story about this couple, and everybody said no. And then I went to the radio stations. I started calling the radio stations, and everyone said no until I got to our beloved WBAI here in New York, which is a community radio station. And I called WBAI, and I said, here's a story. And they said, it sounds like a great story, but we don't have anyone to do it. Why don't you do it? And I grabbed a tape recorder and went to record these folks' story. And it was one of those magical moments where the minute I pushed play and record on the tape recorder, I knew, like, everything else went out the window. Medical school was done, and I'd found the thing I was going to do for the rest of my life. And I was so lucky to find that at 21 or 22 years old. 22 years old, I think I was. And I went back to BA, I cut the story, and that night someone from NPR happened to be driving through Manhattan and was listening to BAI and heard the story and picked it up, and it was on All Things Considered the next week. So it was kind of this crazy week of events, and I was hooked.
And now you're 12 years later, you're a renowned radio genius. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with radio producer David Isay. In a minute, we'll continue our conversation about the art and science of preservation, explore how our understanding of literature is being transformed by computers, and hear some powerful, uniquely American singing that has been preserved from the very old days. Stay with us in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. From PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the award-winning radio producer David Isay, and we're talking about preservation.
From atop the Lowell State Theater building, your American Jewish Hour.
And now, Maestro Sam Medoff and the lads of the Yiddish Swing Ted bring us the rollicking rhythms of Dayenu.
What flavor?
Hey, Mom, can I have some more?
What's all the excitement about?
Haven't you heard? The whole town's talking about the new Manischewitz American Matzos.
There is nothing that quite hits the spot so. Your family will like it a lot so. When they're set to eat, just give them this treat. Manischewitz American Matzo.
You saw that rhyme scheme coming a long way off in that piece. That was an excerpt from one of the rescued Yiddish radio recordings being preserved and cataloged by David Isay and the Yiddish Radio Project. Where did these come from, and why have we, or at least I, never heard of this incredible efflorescence of Yiddish radio in the 30s?
A friend of mine, a collaborator, a guy named Henry Sapoznik, who's this great sort of genius of he's a musician and a collector. And he's actually the person who kind of started the klezmer revival 25, 30 years ago. And about 15 years ago, he tripped over these old Yiddish radio discs. Before the era of tape, shows were preserved on acetate discs in case the FRC, which was a predecessor to the FCC, the Federal Radio Commission, got a complaint. They'd have these shows on disc. And Henry tripped over some and put it on an old transcription disc player and heard this stuff and was completely blown away and spent the last 15 years gathering every scrap, every fragment that exists from this amazing radio tradition. There were all of these Yiddish radio shows in New York in the 30s and 40s. Some of the most, definitely the best radio ever produced was produced on Yiddish radio. It was these kind of eccentric geniuses who got together and were just free to do whatever on the radio.
And did what?
They did dramas. They did man on the street interviews. They did wacky poetry. They did anything. And it's just amazing stuff. I mean, this material just transports you back into this Renaissance period in Jewish life. You are, when you listen to these radio dramas or whatever, you are back in a tenement in 1939, you know, eavesdropping on what it was like to be a Jewish immigrant, you know, struggling to life, adapting to this country. So Henry told me about this collection 5 years ago and started playing me stuff. He played me that matzah commercial, and I was completely floored. I thought it was amazing. The stuff is in Yiddish and English. I don't speak any Yiddish. So Henry and myself and a colleague, a guy named Yair Reiner, who's also working with us on the project, sat and listened to every scrap that Henry'd collected, 2,000 hours. I'm producing some of the early pieces now, and it almost feels like Kent Burns on acid or something like that. I mean, it's like the stuff is so bizarre and so unexpected that it's almost hard to tell whether, you know, is that real? I mean, did that really happen?
Reminds you of the Fire Sign Theater or something?
A little bit.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the award-winning radio producer David Isay, and we're talking about preservation. In our first story today, correspondent Marit Haar looks at what happens to our understanding of literature when authors no longer scribble their changes in the margins of paper manuscripts.
From his cramped office in the Bancroft Library at UC Berkeley, Robert Hurst heads the Mark Twain Project. It's an effort to produce scholarly editions of all Twain's writings by going back to his original letters and papers. As in any professor's office, books and files cover every available surface. But some of the books casually lying about are Mark Twain's own handwritten drafts. With all the solemnity of holding the latest Michael Crichton novel, Hurst pages through a small volume from 1879, containing Chapter 2 of A Tramp Abroad.
If you just look through this, you'll see all kinds of changes that he has made, all the way from different colors of ink to complete sort of crossouts like this. Here's a change that he's made and then pulled back. He says, no, I don't want to do that. We can, with a little effort, make a kind of timeline in which we know pretty much exactly when he's written this, when he comes back to revise it, which we couldn't possibly do if we didn't have this manuscript.
Hurst can also see Twain playing with the order of the book. In a scrawled note at the top of one page, Twain indicates he'd like to insert a certain section, first at page 47, then 97, then 38, then 4, then 2. These days, manuscripts don't usually tell such a full story. There are only a few holdouts who still handwrite their first drafts, and that number will continue to dwindle. Authors of the future may be so comfortable with their word processors and editing programs, they'll never need to scrawl in the margins. At Stanford University, across the quad from the campus clock tower, the Green Library houses the papers of luminaries such as John Steinbeck, Allen Ginsberg, and Tilly Olson. Curator William McFerrin is in charge of American and British literature.
That record of the slow accretion of a work from its initial glimmering inspiration until its final achieved form, that's what we're beginning to lose more and more.
McFerrin says that many authors and editors do continue to print out drafts and mark up the margins, and the conscientious ones are saving these hard copies. But even those printed versions will probably be less informative than anything written before the invention of the delete key. There's also been a serious loss in the move from letters to email. New York-based writer George Packer relied heavily on letters in researching his most recent book, Blood of the Liberals, which traces three generations of political thought within his family. He has misgivings about the straightforwardness of email, where you can never cross out a line.
Certainly for world figures and important writers and political figures, we'll want to know what their second thoughts were and how they amended themselves, and I think we'll have less and less record of that, and just less and less of a sense of the personality, of the idiosyncrasies. It all becomes more and more standard and uniform. It'll just be much harder to find the little details that reveal a character.
But there are, of course, advantages to having all that email. If someone is willing to sift through it, much of what was once lost over the telephone is now there for the reading. And assuming all the software issues do get straightened out, authors who want early versions of their work preserved for posterity just have to make wise use of the save as function.
I wouldn't want to, for a moment, say that email would equal this or equal any of the holograph letters that are over there in that cabinet. I don't think they would. At the same time, Mark Twain would have loved email. He would have had two or three accounts, I'm sure.
For Studio 360, I'm Marit Haar.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with David Isay. David, do you buy that we have that literature is losing something from the absence of ink on paper? That the digital transformation of writing is going to make it impossible or difficult to preserve things that we'd want to preserve?
I mean, I think that it's a lot easier to save multiple drafts of stuff now than it was. I mean, you know, if you're going through multiple drafts of books or whatever, I mean, it's really easy to, you know, toss out intermediate drafts. And with computers, all you do is, as she said in the piece, it's save as. So, you know, and the computers, as a radio person, working in computers has completely, I mean, if you're talking about archiving radio stuff, I mean, everything's done on computers now, and it is so much more easy to trace how a piece was put together. So I'll have 50 drafts of a documentary saved when I would have none saved when I was working on analog tape. But
now, I can see how it represents a certain loss to historians of a certain kind of archaeology. But on the other hand, as knowing how much email I exchange with other writers I know and how much stuff there is out there, in a way that since sort of letter writing died, whenever that was, some decades ago, I think if anything, there's probably more of that kind of potentially historical archival material.
Absolutely.
Sitting on hard drives.
Absolutely. I mean, if it's about sifting through the dirt to find the gold, there'll be a lot more dirt to sift through and probably more gold.
Our next story, in fact, is about the preservation and the resurgence of an old and curious American style of music. Once a year, a couple of hundred people from all over California gather in a church hall or community center, greet some old friends, sit down, and start in singing. And they sing all day long, except for a couple of quick breaks and a potluck lunch. This is a sacred harp singing convention, a tradition that began in the 19th century in the Deep South and gradually died out in the 20th century. The name, Sacred Harp, comes from the biblical Sacred Harp of Daniel. Correspondent Elizabeth Yates McNamee looks at the revival of this archaic musical form.
Oh, Sacred Harp is a fiery, raw-boned kind of American choral music. It's a descendant of four-part singing from New England, which developed as a way to improve the singing in church. By the early 18th century, congregational singing had really deteriorated. Ministers complained, and local musicians began to write four-part sacred songs, which were published in little songbooks and taught in classes called singing schools. This music became known as shape note singing, because in the songbooks, the notes are printed in four different shapes: a triangle, a circle, a square, and a diamond. They're called fa, sol, la, and mi. In the early 1800s, shape note singing spread to the Old South, acquiring its own sound and traditions. People would gather in little country churches on days when their circuit preacher was somewhere else. They'd arrange the benches and chairs in four sections, facing in towards the center of the room, and they'd sing.
One shepherd was there brought by night, oh, sitting on the ground, the angel of the...
I remember going to Sacred Harp singings with my grandmother, and I would just be mesmerized by this stuff as a small kid. There were other small kids or children around my age there, and they would, you know, at some point go outside or play or whatever, but not me. You know, I was right in there the whole time, just enthralled by it.
Richard DeLong has spent most of his 34 years in Carroll County, Georgia, about an hour west of Atlanta. He remembers when sacred harp singing was popular and how, as people spent more time with the passive entertainments of movies and television, sacred harp singing began to decline.
It used to be such a... basically a Southern thing, carried on and preserved in the rural areas. You know, it was entertainment. It was the event to come out to. And then families became strong in it and passed it along to the next generation. But all of that has really, really changed now. There's a singing held on the second Sunday in June in Alpharetta at the courthouse. Now it's the City Hall building. There are Atlanta newspaper accounts of them roping off the town on Sunday, because the crowds would be so huge. 3,000 to 5,000 people would come to town to enjoy the second Sunday in June all day singing. And to imagine something like that today, it would be incredible.
In the 1960s and 70s, people outside the South began to discover the power of this music.
I discovered a copy of Southern Harmony, and I was fascinated by this this book, and I knew there must be more to doing this than just the notes on the page.
Neely Bruce is professor of music and American studies at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. He grew up in Alabama, but he first encountered Sacred Harp as a graduate student at the University of Illinois.
So I went to the library, and I got the Alan Lomax recording of an all-day singing in Fife, Alabama, which was recorded in 1954. And I listened to that record, and it was like a conversion experience. I thought it was the most wonderful thing I'd ever heard in my life. I played it, and my family went totally crazy. I played nothing but this record for 2 weeks. I thought I'd worn it out when I finally returned it to the library.
This song, Wondrous Love, is from that recording, which inspired many non-Southerners to try singing Sacred Harp. Neely Bruce helped organize the first Sacred Harp singing in New England in 1976, when a chartered Greyhound bus from Georgia and a flower-painted school bus from Vermont brought elderly Southerners and Northern hippies together to sing. Now there are singing conventions throughout the year and around the country. Each begins with a traditional singing school, and Richard DeLong teaches many of them.
That first note there is a round note, and that's our soul. Soul, like the sun, round. And then the next note is fa, it's the triangle, the right side of the triangle note. So the scale actually runs fa, sol, la, fa, sol, la, mi, fa. Okay, so let's sing up this scale. Does everybody sing the scale? I'll give you the key note. Here we go.
In a singing school, beginners learn how to sing each song through first on the fa sol la shapes, then on the words themselves. And they learn how to sing out full-voiced with a strong rhythmic pulse, and, perhaps most important, how to sing in the formation called the hollow square, facing the center, so that those big open harmonies resonate together.
When you mix all the things together, when you mix the tradition together of sitting in the hollow square, that's very important. There's purpose for that. You know, so that the sound travels all to the center of that square where the leader stands from the four parts. And when the singers outside of the tradition discover that and the real purpose starts hitting them, it's a powerful thing. You get something far beyond just the music. You get this incredible sense of family and closeness with one another, and that you're actually part of something big. It's part of something spiritual, if you want to call it spiritual.
Most sacred harp singers today come from the urban north rather than the rural south, and from every imaginable religious background. Many say they felt strange at first, singing these songs that have such a fundamentalist Christian basis. But they find that the intensity of this music forges a spiritual bond among the singers, so that differences in religion or denomination become irrelevant.
I love the passion, the closeness of the people, the fact that it's entirely for the singers and not for performance. It's just for us.
It feels like it's really coming from within me, and as a direct expression, it's not being filtered through expectations. It's just me in a community of singers.
I wouldn't walk across the street to hear it, but would walk 200 miles to sing it.
Richard DeLong is right. It's hard to understand the power of sacred harp music just by reading the funny-looking notes in the book, or even by hearing recordings. And you can't attend a performance because there aren't any. To get the feeling of sacred harp, you have to sit in the hollow square and sing. And then you might understand why this unique American tradition has survived.
If you don't like this kind of music, you better stay away from it, because it'll get a hold of you.
For Studio 360, I'm Elizabeth Yates McNamee.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with radio producer David Isay. You've documented, David, in your radio pieces, religious practices outside the mainstream. I mean, snake handlers and Virgin Mary spotters and Times Square evangelists and so forth. Is there a common thread to all those sorts of people who have this kind of peculiar spiritual passions?
You know, there is something about this sort of preservation. That I mean, everybody likes, when we're talking about the sacred harp stuff, I mean, it's like, it's a time travel thing. I mean, everybody, there's this kind of fancy element to stuff that I think is appealing to people. I remember when I was a kid, I don't know what this has to do with anything exactly, but I used to just sit and look at like photo albums for hours and hours and hours. And there was this weird sort of like transporting thing about that. And it's I always found it was an odd feeling. There's something like kind of, I don't know, it was kind of like addictive, and it was something like mildly like depressing about it also. But to
in a minute, we'll hear about how museums are struggling to preserve contemporary art out of some unorthodox materials. Large. Anderson, special guest here in 60, where the life collides. RI, Public Radio International. In studio with David Isay. That sound was the sound of anti-preservation. It was the implosion that destroyed the MIPS Hotel in Reno, Nevada. Despite years of court battles and campaigns to preserve it. David, you've talked to people who've managed to build and preserve their own less elaborate structures and environments. I'm thinking of a book, Jim Bickle's Castle, or Donald Bean and his dinosaur gardens in Moscow, Texas. How do they manage to hold on and to keep their materials are also in New York in late 20th, 21st century.
In New York, aggression. Is certainly challenging for conservators.
Art sometimes creates chocolate large. Jenny Antoni.
I'm working with Cowhide, Rawhide.
subject over time. Janine Antoni thinks that in some ways collective art is about living on, and that maybe we care so much about preserving collective change.
This idea of preservation has sort of to think of objects or experiences. For instance, that only lasts a short time, but part of the beauty of that flower is that it is ephemeral. And I think the work conservation in that way, too.
But it's not just today's artworks that raise these sculptures made of foam.
Were used are in fact going to deteriorate. If the artist is here to give us